on ABC Local Radio, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web. This is Sunday Nights with John Cleary.
Hi there, good to have you with us. Well, tonight as Australian politics weathers another crisis, we'll be crossing to the United States where Tom Roberts, editor-at-large of the National Catholic Reporter, looks at another political party and its leaders tearing at itself in public. Only this time it seems it's okay. It's called primary season. Here at home also, we'll be meeting some participants in the first National Hoarding and Squalor Conference held in Sydney this weekend. Yes, it could be you. And tonight's instalment of The Good Life, Noel takes us in search of the celebration of Lent in Egypt's Coptic community in Australia. And later, the Reverend Canon Frank Sheehan of St. George's Cathedral in Perth will be along to pick up the pieces in the chat room. And yes, there will be an Inquisition. 1-300-800-222 is the number to call, but save that up for a little later on. First up tonight, Noel Debien introduces us to an author whose academic interests have suddenly taken on contemporary relevance. It's Paul Marshall. He's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute Center for Religious Freedom and the author and editor of more than 20 books on religion and politics, especially with regard to religious freedom. He's written on Sharia law, Hindu extremism, the Taliban, and Egypt's Christians, and particularly with regard to religious persecution. So let's say hi to Noel with Paul Marshall, and by way of introduction, here's a touch of the Beatles.
On a revolution, well, you know, we all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution, well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? Don't you know it's gonna be alright? Alright. Alright. You say you got a real solution. Love to see the plan. You ask me for a contribution. Well, you know, we all do what we can. But if you want money for people with minds that hate, all I can tell you is, brother, you have to wait. You know it's gonna be All right.
From the Beatles there, a choice of our guest, Paul Marshall, senior fellow from the Hudson Institute Center for Religious Freedom. Paul, the Beatles. Now, there's a story behind that, isn't there?
There is. My one and only claim to fame is that I was at school with George Harrison and Paul McCartney.
Speaking terms?
No, because they're older than me, of course. They'd be, you know, when they were 15, they weren't going to talk to a 12-year-old. So I have touched greatness, though greatness has not touched me. And my life has been downhill from the, you know, just a wreck, really.
Well, I've been reading up, I've got to say, and there's lots of interesting things to talk about in this hour. More serious than some of the Beatles' music, I've got to say. Can I begin in looking across your writing? Mm-hmm. It looks like one major focus for you has been ideology and religion.
Yes.
Ideology. Mm-hmm. Now, what's gotten you into that area?
Because I'm religious myself, and I'm an Episcopalian in America, and historically, my doctorate's in political philosophy. It was on the influence of theology on English political thought. I see these influences sort of everywhere, and see lots of people not noticing them or misunderstanding them. Religion and politics are always and everywhere intertwined, and they will never be untwined. We can get into that. The key is, how should they be related, and how do we understand them? So that's, in terms of a lot of my academic work when I used to be a professor, that's the sort of thing I've been looking at. And then you look at the contemporary world now, where they're so intertwined. My simple way of putting it is, if you want to understand the modern world, you have to understand religion.
Oh, you're a perfect guest for our program, well, because that's you. What we focus on. Thank you very much. Okay. Can I touch on a few of the thorny issues, I suppose, that I've mm-hmm. come across as you've tried to approach them, understand them, and reason about them? Islam has been a focus of study and how it yeah. operates. Mm-hmm. Let's begin there.
Okay. And background for that, one of my big things I look at is issues of religious freedom internationally, globally. Things can be very bad in many places, in Vietnam or China, in Burma, Sudan, Saudi Arabia. But the area where religious repression is growing is in the Muslim world. You know, Vietnam is not trying to get other people to do what it does. It doesn't care what others do. It cares what bad happens at home. But the extremist forms of Islam, which have grown and I think are still growing, have an export model. They want other Muslims to be like them. They want to persuade them to do that. If they won't be persuaded, they may kill them. But they want sort of a particular reactionary view of Islam imposed on the Muslim world and then outside the Muslim world. So it's growing, it's spreading. So for that reason, I've spent a lot of attention in the last 10, 15 years on Islam, on the Muslim world, both dealing with terrorism. I started writing about terrorism because after the attacks in the U.S. on what's called 9/11, all the groups people were talking about, I knew about. I knew about these groups. I knew about Al-Qaeda.
You'd already been studying them.
Yes, because of religious freedom. I wasn't like a terrorism expert, national security guy, any of these things. But I could tell you how many churches had been bombed in Indonesia, and it was dozens. A group called Lashkar Jihad did that, and that had been killing people elsewhere. Oh. If I looked at the Sudan, I know Bin Laden. He was in Sudan for many years. He had connections with the slave trade in Sudan. So suddenly, groups which were new to almost everywhere, I knew them not as a terrorism guy, but as a religious freedom guy. And so I pursued those elements. So let me just mention, I've got a book coming out in October this year called Silenced. Mm-hmm. Subtitle, How Blasphemy Restrictions Are Choking Freedom Worldwide, Freedom of Religion and Freedom of Speech. And this addresses in the Muslim world, but then in the West concerning Islam, that people are shut up if they're thought to be insulting religion or defaming religion, particularly Islam. And we may call it hate speech or defaming religion, but it's blasphemy laws like they have in Pakistan and other places. And the survey is meant to show how widespread these are and how strong their effect is. And when you think of insulting religion and who might be doing this, don't think of an idiot Florida pastor who burns Korans. Okay, I mean, that is an insulting religion. He's not typical. He's unusual. Think of somebody else like the former governor of the largest province in Pakistan. Over half the population of the country are in Punjab province. Salman Taseer.
Assassinated.
Was assassinated for opposing the blasphemy law. And a quote from his daughter, Sarah, who said, "This is a message to every liberal. Shut up or be shot." That's one of the things the blasphemy law is about. You know, the victims aren't insulters in the sense we usually talk about. They're people like Taseer, you know, a courageous Democrat. And then the only Christian cabinet minister in Pakistan, the minister of minorities, Shahbaz Bhatti.
Assassinated.
So this is what we're talking about. And we're talking about Pakistani journalists. We're talking about Afghan journalists. We're talking about the intelligentsia in Egypt, who write about ways they should, interpret the Quran. And the one Abu Zayd, who we include a section on him in the book, had to flee Egypt because of his writings. He was a committed Muslim, but radicals said, these writings show you're not a Muslim, therefore you're an apostate, so you can't be married to a Muslim. And they got a court declaration that he was forcibly divorced from his wife. He fled, and his wife, to the Netherlands. This is who we're talking about.
you have quoted him in some of your writing.
Yes.
Where he says, having been at the receiving end of such allegations, as in blasphemy and apostasy, and driven from my home in Egypt to exile in the Netherlands, I can state with conviction that charges of apostasy and blasphemy are key weapons in the fundamentalists' arsenal, strategically employed to prevent reform of Muslim societies.
Yep.
That's tough stuff coming from a Muslim.
Yeah, and it is. He's a victim. And to mention, the foreword to the book is written by Abdulrahman Wahid, colloquially known as Gastur. Former president of the world's largest Muslim country, Indonesia. Former president of the world's largest Muslim organization, Nahdlatul Ulama. The last thing he wrote before he died is the foreword to this book, because he also argues eloquently. He says, these are laws which stifle Muslim societies. And even in Indonesia, comparatively open societies. When I go to, last time I was in Indonesia, they had me on a radio program for Ramadan, a three-part, you know, interviewing someone who's not a Muslim discussing Ramadan. It's still a very open society. But now you're getting Ahmadiyyas, who are sort of dissident, maybe heretical Muslims, being killed in Indonesia, of all places. Attacks on churches. So Gastur was well aware of this, and you know, he provided this introduction. This is a problem we've got to fight within the Muslim world. And one of our big worries now is that the West is sliding into importing these things. We're saying, well, we should stop insulting religion. That's bad. Well, it is bad. But you try and make laws around that, and you will be locking up, you will be shutting down, you know, any discussion about politics and religion insofar as it deals with Islam.
Well, I do want to pick up there, and I want to put on my big rubber hands as an interviewer and just point out that when I first started reading your stuff, I thought, oh, is this guy anti-Muslim? It was my first worry that I would find somewhere where you went right off the rails. I was I was sort of worried that that was going to be the case. Now, you've mentioned Gastur, Abdulrahman Wahid. You've mentioned many Muslim friends of yours. I just want to say straight out that from my reading, it became clear to me that you're not anti-Islam.
No, I'm not. The big conflict in the world today, it's of religion and violence, is within Islam. And you have major figures like Abu Zayd, major figures like Gastur. I'll mention another person that this is, we're talking about the forthcoming book, Silenced, which is authored. But in writing that book, we thought, we're surveying what happens in the contemporary world, but we do need to make an argument that Islam does not require civil penalties for apostasy or blasphemy. You can throw them out of your mosque or whatever. I think people are free to do that. But the government shouldn't be involved. And I'm not equipped to make that argument from Muslim history and Muslim text. So I asked Abu Zayd, would he write one, which he did. Another person who wrote an essay on this is actually an Australian, Abdullahi Saeed, who teaches at the University of Melbourne. Mm-hmm. He and his brother wrote a book saying, you know, on Islamic Muslim grounds that there should be no civil penalty for apostasy for leaving Islam. And so he gave that essay. And another example of who gets repressed. He wrote that with his brother, who was then the Attorney General of the Maldives.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that book is now banned in the Maldives. Okay, a book written by the Attorney General making an argument, you're not allowed to read it. This is what's going on, and that's why so many Muslims want to fight these blasphemy laws.
Without going out of my door,
the Beatles, their choice of our guest, Dr. Paul Marshall from the Hudson Centre Institute for Religious Freedom. Here on ABC Local Radio around Australia with me, Noel Debien. Paul Marshall, we've talked through the ideology of religions, and we've spent a fair bit of time on Islam for the reasons you've just discussed. But another issue you raise is the media and our failure to get at the real story in religion, politics and their interaction. What are your concerns here?
Two things. One is an argument we make is that religion is increasingly important throughout the world, in personalized, but focus here is more on the political side. And there are exceptions. Australia may be one. I'm not. Western Europe's another. But in the world at large, the importance of religion is increasing. When you get democratization, it increases even more, because the population is usually more religious than the elite. So that's increasing. So this means for many contemporary news stories, we've talked about terrorism as one, but if you look at, say, coverage of the war in Iraq, often they didn't know what was going on. They weren't really sure what Shiites were and weren't aware of the tremendous difference between Iraqi Shiites and Iranian Shiites.
You're talking about our newsrooms, basically.
I'm talking about our newsrooms.
Yeah.
I mean, our politicians too, but here we're talking about the newsrooms. In terms of understanding American elections or American politics generally, that religion is a much better determinant of voting in America. If you want to know how someone votes, ask them about their religion. Don't ask them about their income or their class. That has an effect too. But religion has a large effect. You know, looking at movies, we actually have a chapter on Mel Gibson. But looking at more recent movies who's talked about, Terrence Malick, who's later, you know, much talked about, highly intelligent movie maker. His latest book is called The Tree of Life. It's sort of visual meditation on the book of Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Malick is Assyrian in background, an Iraqi Christian.
Mm.
And I often find, I'm not a skilled movie reviewer, but I often find when I've seen a movie and I'm reading a review of saying, there's religious overtones here. Well, not just overtones, undertones, and right in the middle, and people had not seen that. Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ, was major discussion in the United States, saying it wasn't faithful to the New Testament, and it was a misreading. It could ignite anti-Semitism, which it didn't. But what it was structured on was the Stations of the Cross.
There were also influences of Blessed Katerina Emmerich, though.
Yes, there were.
An unusual mystic, weren't
they? Oh, yeah. That was a weird one. It gets tied into his, sort of Mel's
his particular
unusual
spirituality.
Catholicism.
Yeah.
But the actual structure, if you go through it, the set piece scene would be obvious to a Catholic who knows the Stations of the Cross.
Oh, I found it deeply moving.
Yeah, it's right there. But people, it says, it's not a New Testament narrative in the sense of the Gospels, which have many things. It's the structured liturgical narrative of the Stations of the Cross.
Of course, yeah.
And people didn't notice that. And I don't expect, you know, a reporter covering city politics in Sydney to know that. But you're going to write about, a movie about the death of Christ. Someone should have read up on that. So even in movies...
Missing on a movie critique, you're saying there's something very obvious which is not being mentioned here.
Yeah. So, you know, much of this is across the board. And the sociologists are finding, even in secular societies like Western Europe, and I would hazard the guess, even Australia, most of the people are still very religious. They don't want to go to church. But actually, they don't want to go to anything organized. So, you know, people have been at home for a while. We've asked people, do they believe in God? Do they pray? These sorts of questions.
Do they have a sense of spirituality?
You ask a spirituality question, and that, you know, then you're bouncing up the 70s and 80s.
And it's true that what you say is corroborated in voluntary groups and in civil society in general. There's a falling away of commitment to public groupings, basically, and institutions, let it be said.
Yeah. In a place like Australia, I think it's true, there is a sort of loss of religious faith, the number of religious people. But there's also a phenomenon that it's changing, that it's still there. It's much less expressed in people showing up on a Sunday morning.
Why is this critical in media, though, particularly in our news reporting and our current affairs? Because we've mentioned movie review and the media missing these things.
Yep.
But why is it very important, from your point of view, that our journalists understand the religious subtext, or in fact the motivations that are going on here? Let me give you an example.
Yep.
I was fascinated when I really looked into the Iranian Revolution, and I began to understand more about its particular brand of Shiite Islam, my eyes were opened as to why the Ayatollah had so much influence. The Mahdi.
Yes. And the Mahdi is, to use a Christian term which doesn't fit, but is this sort of messianic figure, not necessarily the one at the end of times, but the coming of the holy figure, the saint, who will restore the glory of the Muslim world. In Shiite Islam, you also have the notion of the hidden imam, who's waiting to reappear.
Still waiting, he's coming.
Ahmadinejad is very big on this. Many Iranians are, but that's very big for him. Enough so, and you know, there's a huge power struggle within the government of Iran right now. And several of Ahmadinejad's the president, his aides have been accused of sorcery by people allied with the supreme leader, Khamenei. Why? Because they think, partly it's politically to undercut them.
We've read this here, the sorcery charges.
Yeah. Yes. And the views of the hidden imam are getting so weird and strange, and the things they're trying to do, it's becoming magic, not Islam. So this is seriously meant, and this debate is going on here. And I'm great, you know, we've had it here, but...
There yet could be blood spilled over this,
too. There could be blood spilled. There could be a regime could crack on this. Yeah, not nukes, not the other stuff, but whether there's too much sorcery going on in the president's office. And I've seen this, I've seen reporting in the mainstream media on this, but largely this is missed. You know, sorcery does not compute. You get a lot of sorcery charges in Saudi Arabia too, by the way.
And you're arguing that at the basis of those who are people of faith, whether that's organized religion or not, that there are motivations which are driving people, is what you're basically saying. And the media is oftentimes missing these motivations, these significant ones.
Yeah. And my most sort of oversimplified formulation is four things drive human beings: money, sex, power, and faith. Media tends to think it must be money, sex, and power. Often don't notice faith, but if they do, they think it's a cover for something else. It's a sort of Marxism, needn't be left-wing, but
it's sort of
religion
fake.
Is the superstructure. We need to look at the real things underneath. It's evanescent. Religion doesn't make people do something. It's a false consciousness, disguising the fact that they're really doing something. Now, often that's true. I mean, I interact with enough religion to know that things can be a cover for
there are frauds,
some other. Yeah. There are frauds. And all. Yeah. But the problem is it tends to be read out of court and saying we must look for the real motivation, which couldn't be religion.
Dr. Paul Marshall, we've run out of time. I would love to carry this conversation on again, and we'll endeavour to have you back again. It's been a fascinating journey into motivations of religious belief, and thank you very much for being part of the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Beatles there. Almost friends of our guest, Paul Marshall, speaking there with Noel DeBeern on Sunday nights. You're with John Cleary, and Noel and Paul Marshall were discussing the emphasis, the influence of religion on politics. Well, we'll pick up that theme a little later in the program, but for now we're going to stick with some music. Naturally 7 were the surprise hit of last year's Michael Bublé tour of Australia. They were his support act, an extraordinary vocal group, a black American a cappella vocal ensemble drawing its heritage from gospel, pop and jazz. They'll be returning to Australia mid-2012, and I caught up with them immediately following the Bublé tour. So for the next little while, let's enjoy Naturally 7.
Is love, that is all I'm thinking of.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. The music you just heard is that of a quite remarkable group, Naturally Seven. And two of the group are joining us now in the studio. It's welcome to Roger Thomas and Rod Eldridge of Naturally Seven. Welcome to Sunday Night.
Hey, good to be here.
Nice to be here. Definitely.
Great to have you with us. Roger, that music is quite remarkable. Let's talk first about the musical sound and how you decided to get at it. It's not just a vocal line with a bit of harmony thrown in, a bit of close harmony. There are actual musical effects there. You sustain the entire musical ensemble from within your voices. How did that come to be?
Well, at some point, we decided that we wanted to become the band in the essence of actually becoming the instruments. We call that vocal play now, just to differentiate from just normal a cappella. So a cappella is when you sing without instruments. Everybody knows that. Vocal play is when you become the instrument, and we decided to do that just because we found that we had it in us to do. It wasn't something I auditioned the guys to do because we were a bunch of friends that just got together, but we found little by little that each person had this uncanny ability to become at least a couple of instruments.
A couple of instruments is a sort of modest way of putting it, really. The percussion is something that I found quite extraordinary. I saw your concert with Michael Bublé, or you opened the concert with Michael Bublé, and that percussion effect. And now that's your brother, isn't it, Roger?
That is correct. Warren, yeah.
Hey, where did that come from?
Well, my mother would not get him a drum set. So that's the earliest thing I remember, recall of him starting to just do these drum sounds. Same thing with guitar, too. He does a pretty mean guitar, but he is the official drummer in the band. And one day when we wanted a little bit of rhythm going, he had tried a little something. And I said, you know what, if you can keep that up, then we can put that in a song. And at first, he could only do it for a minute or so. So we would create arrangements where he would just do these drum sounds for a minute and then go back to singing and then jump in again. And then little by little, he was able to do it for a whole song and then for 10 minutes and 30 minutes. And now we do 2-hour to 3-hour shows.
And you started doing this in church, I understand.
Yes, yes. That is the root of, us learning to harmonize with each other, understanding close harmonies and that type of thing. And that's what we did. We started with pretty much choral type of arrangements. And but because we had this pretty extensive background, all of us, in terms of what we listened to, from, gospel to classical to country to funk, we just decided that, okay, we're going to see if we can put a little bit of everything in a lot of our songs.
It's sort of gospel hip-hop you'd describe it as now. I mean, what would you describe it as? How is it categorized?
That's the interesting thing, because it's very hard to categorize it. One of our early releases, musically on CD, was a CD called "What Is It?" Because no one could figure out exactly what to call it, because they said, it's not exactly a cappella anymore, and it's not exactly hip hop, and it's not exactly R&B. It's, we just threw so many of our influences in it, and. Right now, we just hope that some people call it good music,
Rod Eldridge, let me bring you into the conversation now. When did you get into the group and how?
As pretty much an original member of Naturally Seven. However, I've known some of these guys and Roger since about 1992. And have been singing with these guys in some form since then. But when we decided to start Naturally Seven, I was there in the beginning, and
did you go to the same church as these guys did?
Part of the same denomination. I went to church with I attended a church with Warren. I didn't go to the church in the Bronx where it first started. We part of the same denomination, so we kind of had there's a certain kind of a family there of various churches around the city, and you would recognize a guy from one of the churches that he maybe singing in this choir or singing in another group or singing solos, and so you kind of have this network, and that's kind of how we kind of come together.
You're on Sunday Night. We're enjoying a little close-up with Naturally Seven, particularly Roger Thomas, founder and musical director of the group, and Rod Eldridge describes himself as first tenor and DJ of Naturally Seven. Let's hear a little more of Naturally Seven, and this is something recorded just for us in the ABC studios. Keep the customers satisfied. Who's going to introduce it for us?
I will. This is a piece there, even though we've taken the title from our good friend Simon and Garfunkel. This is something where we just, that's exactly what we intend to do. Keep our customers satisfied at the Naturally Seven restaurant of music.
Tell me what you want. Tell me what you need. Recipe switching, I'm the chef in the kitchen, and I know just what you're thinking. I could give you what you're wishing for. Just tell me if you're sure, and I will give you more.
I keep my customers satisfied. Keep your customers satisfied.
Have you been here before? I know it feels familiar, but it's a slight detour. You're dying from suspense, this won't kill ya. What can I do to get a second glance? Ain't nothing new under the sun, you gotta feel it to dance. Don't hesitate to reminisce, connect the dots. I'll elevate you, yeah, let's take it up a notch. And I say, tell me what you want. Tell me what you need. Recipe switching, I'm the chef in the kitchen, and I know just what you're thinking. I could give you what you're wishing for. Just tell me if you're sure, and I will give you more.
I keep my customers satisfied.
Customers satisfied. Naturally Seven on ABC Radio on Sunday Night. Our guests are Roger Thomas and Rod Eldridge of the group Naturally Seven. Roger, you recently toured, as I mentioned, with Michael Bublé. Now, that tour is interesting in that you were the opening act, the support act for Bublé. He obviously recognised your musical worth. Yet, in that introductory set, preparing the way for Bublé, you nevertheless made it clear that you actually had another project as well, that you weren't just singers, that you had a message, that you're quite explicit about the Christian background to what you were saying. How important is that to you as a group?
It really is important to us. It's probably just as important to us as doing vocals only music. That's what we know when it comes to just doing vocals only. And it's the same thing with our message. We pretty much got into the business to actually bring something always positive, inspirational, spiritual to the table in an industry where that just doesn't happen very often.
Now, Michael Bublé was, he can be a little raunchy, a little fresh. Does it bother you at all?
Well, we understand the industry. I think to say whether it bothers us, it doesn't bother us. We're around a lot more freshness and that type of stuff. We feel honored that he's allowed us to do what we do. You know, just before he comes up, you know, he's been free. I remember asking him one day, I said, you know, would it be okay if we did Amazing Grace? He was like, sure. Do what you guys do. If that's what you want to do, you do that. So, you know, I wasn't sure if it was, you know, going to take things in a too much of a, you know, uplifting direction, for, you know, but he pretty much was a guy that was just like, oh, no, do what's true to you guys, and we really, really appreciate that, and look for the opportunity to do it any place we can, really.
You've still got to bear in mind, and it's very interesting that he was open to that, to bear in mind where he's going with his material too, and you can't sort of shift the whole tone and direction of the concert, can you? You've actually got to be pretty sensitive about that yourselves.
Yes, it's true. It's true. You just can't just do any particular thing. But I think at the end of the day, people look at the concert as a night that they had a chance to celebrate voice. And even with our message, as I think you just put it, we really don't beat people over the head with anything. We're very, very subtle with it, just like having a conversation with you right now. You know, if you'd ask me certain questions, I'd tell you, give you certain answers. And if you didn't ask me certain questions, I would still give you certain answers. So that is what, you know, our mission is. A lot of times people in the music industry, they have, you know, they have different agendas, like, hey, I want to lead people in this particular direction. For us, we realize that the most lasting thing that people can get when they walk away from music is if they are touched with, you know, with inspiration from something spiritual. It's like the most most lasting thing. So that's good for us.
Rod, let me ask you about the life of the group as a religious project, if you like, because you've put your religion right front and center. And as you say, you don't beat people over the head with it, but it's evident where you're coming from. You must see your work in the group as in some way a religious project. How do you sustain that in the business you're in? Because the business you're in is really designed to drain every ounce of spirituality out of you in the sheer workload, the pressure, the being away from your families for long periods of time. It's a pretty tough life.
It certainly can be. I mean, the nature of the business is generally fueled by, you know, the almighty dollar, as it was said. What can we sell? What can we market? And what do people want to, you know, spend a dollar on? And so our mission has been to say, you know what, we're going to keep it positive and up, because people think that, you know, they say, you know, a lot of negativity is kind of where people, you know, want to focus on and what sells. But we believe that, you know, we can actually be positive. We can be an inspiration. We can be a beacon, if you will, and that if you package it right, you know, people are going to buy it. People are going to be there, and when they leave, they're going to say, that's something that – and it's different, and we want to come back for it. And I'm sorry. And as far as the you know, our family and the life and all that, you know, that's a challenge. I will probably say – and we generally say it's probably the hardest part about what we do is the fact that we are on the road as much as we are kind of doing – it's a ministry. We are on the road quite a bit. And the blessing about that is if you have supportive in that, we do have some very supportive families and the people that love and value what we do as much as we do. And if that's the case, you can find success. If it were not that way, if – they dreaded it and didn't see the worth in it and the value and love it, then you'd have a harder road, but you've been blessed.
You're on Sunday Night. Our guests are Naturally Seven, Roger Thomas and Rod Eldridge from the group. Let's have another piece of music, again recorded specially for our ABC listeners in our ABC Brisbane studios. a Simon and Garfunkel medley. Roger, Simon and Garfunkel, musically not where you're at, but I guess it's the lyrically, the lyric stuff that appeals here.
Well, it's just something that growing up in my home, my father was very strict about the music we listened to. We didn't have very many actually secular recordings in the home. And one of those recordings was the Simon and Garfunkel album. And I think my father believed that, you know, Paul Simon was just a great songwriter. Mm-hmm. And he would always say, listen to these lyrics. What do you think this means? What do you think he's getting at here? And it wouldn't always be clear to a 10 or 11-year-old, you know, what was exactly going on. And I think that's what got me into songwriting and into just trying to decipher, you know, those things. So oftentimes in our show, we try to, you know, just show like some of the music, even if it's not religious or inspiration, you know, coming from inspiration. Just like here's some of the stuff that we actually grew up listening to. And here's Naturally Seven's arrangement harmonically of it.
Darkness, my old friend, I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its scenes while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. Now grown up.
tribute to Simon and Garfunkel, Naturally 7 on Sunday night. Roger Thomas and Rod Eldridge are our guests. How do you go about putting your arrangements together? Do you just start off intuitively with a little drum pattern and then build it up vocally, or do you actually get somebody in to do sort of formally structured arrangements for you? How does it develop?
Well, even if it's a formally structured arrangement, it's going to start from one of us in the band. Oftentimes I'll put something together that's, put in the, okay, this is what the drums are going to be doing, this is what the bass is, here's the basic licks on the guitar and that type of thing, and then the guys pretty much improvise from there or give, just give their interpretation of something that I've kind of brought to the table. But a song can actually start from anything. It can start just from somebody. It can start from Warren doing a beat. It can start from a bass line. It can start from a guitar lick. It can start from one single lyric. In fact, we started writing a song 2 days ago, and I just walked into the group and said, the name of the song is We're Almost There. And all I've got is this line right here, and then everybody started building on it from there. And probably within about an hour and a half, we had half a song. So sometimes it's done like that. It's inspiration comes from any one of the different, musical things that could go on. And that's the beautiful thing about being in a band where you can do it anywhere.
Your career has taken off over the last year or so. This tour of Australia has been virtually a sellout. How do you balance that? And what's the next big ambition you have?
Well, besides taking over the world, obviously, we'd love, I say that as a joke, but there's some truth to it. We'd love Naturally 7's name to be a household name when it comes to a cappella, when it comes to vocal music, this term we use, vocal play. We'd like that to be, just a household term. When people think of, just like you said, Manhattan Transfer, there was a time when anybody thinks of anything, kind of jazzy vocal, Manhattan Transfer or Take Six or Bobby McFerrin. We definitely want, when the history books are written, for somebody to say Naturally 7, Naturally 7. That's the Naturally 7 way of doing something, or that's Naturally 7-ish. When you get that ish on your name, that's when you've, that's Beatles-ish. That's Bee Gees. Ish, Earth, Wind, and Fire ish. That's Naturally 7-ish.
We look for the Wikipedia entry.
Right.
Naturally 7, Masters of Vocal Play on Sunday night. It's been fabulous to have you with us. We're going to finish, Roger, with a little more of your music. Roger and Rod of Naturally 7, Rod Eldridge, Roger Thomas, thank you so much.
And it's been a pleasure.
Let's finish with the great Simon and Garfunkel. Sort of many people saw it as sort of their hymn, wasn't it? It became the sort of religious Simon and Garfunkel.
That's right, that's right.
Bridge Over Troubled Water. Roger Thomas, Rod Eldridge, thanks for joining us on Sunday night.
Excellent, thank you for having us.
When you're with